Chapter 15. Management. In this chapter, I talk about creating culture, cutting meetings, and holding teams accountable. I love being a manager, and I love talking about management. It's similar to the topic of leadership, but in my mind, management is almost synonymous with mentorship. One of the great pleasures of running Wine Library and VaynerMedia has been the opportunity it has given me to show people how to be better managers. We all probably have our own opinions of what makes a good manager. But in this one man's point of view, it's the ability to reverse engineer every person that works for you and put him or her in the best position to succeed at the task for which they have been hired. That's what I try to do for the people who report to me. And that's what I expect the people who report to me to do for the people who report to them. In less than 4 years, VaynerMedia grew from 20 to 600 employees. And in most of that time, we only had one person in the HR department, me. That's how much my employees matter to me. Every company lies about how much they care about their customers and how much they care about their employees. It's such an easy thing to say, but it's really hard to put in the work that proves it. From the very beginning, when AJ and I were starting VaynerMedia, we made a few key decisions and set standards that we swore would be upheld no matter what. We did this because we saw too many companies become breeding grounds for unhappiness, places where uninspired, unappreciated minds went to wither. Just to really make everybody understand what I tell a client, clients want to sell stuff to people. So I tell them, look, first and foremost, my employees matter to me most, more than your business. Second, I care about your customers, because that's what you should care about too. And your third, which is a brain twist for a lot of people that are in B2B and agency and service businesses, because a lot of times that person's first, right? The client, and then everything comes second. This has been a major reason VaynerMedia has exploded, because I think I've got those things in the proper order. The quality of management in any venture is, like its cousin leadership, one of the core determinants of whether a business will succeed or fail. You want the people working with you to want to be there, to feel challenged, appreciated, and valued. People always respect and like the manager who's thinking ahead and guiding them to places they never thought of. But they love and admire when that manager stays with them until 2 a.m. working that deck or stocking that shelf. Is that you? A disproportionate number of the listeners of this book are managers or will be someday. In fact, the day you launched an entrepreneurial venture, you became a manager. One of the reasons I was excited to record this book was that I knew it would allow me to freely explore some of the topics about which I'm passionate, and that have made the Ask Gary Vee show so much fun. Management is at the top of that list.
Hey guys, it's Dustin Keller, former tight end for the New York Jets. So glad to have the opportunity to read the next 10 questions for my boy, the one and only Gary Vee, in the Gary Vee book. Where is the best place to hire employees?
Big shout out to Dustin Keller. You know, this gets me jazzed up as much as Draymond's my buddy. I'm a Knicks fan, but the Jets are my heart. Great to hear from you, Dustin. Hope you're doing well. You know, there's a lot of places you can go for employees. I think word of mouth is incredibly interesting, like just talking to friends, things of that nature. There's obviously a ton of sites, Indeed, all these great platforms. I'm a big fan of Twitter. Twitter.com/search. You search that search engine on Twitter for any keyword. So if I'm looking to hire a web designer, I can type in CSS or front end code or web design, all these different terms. Cause sometimes the reason I started with CSS and things of that nature is if you go too broad, you get a lot of junk and a lot of ads. So the further you can go down into your business, right? For example, I would search if I was looking to hire a wine person, Pinot Gris, because I know there'd be ads around Pinot Noir and Cabernet, but Pinot Gris is a little nerdier, right? So that kind of stuff. So know your craft. You do, it's your business. Search terms that are a little bit more long tail, not the generic terms, because you'll be more efficient weeding through all those tweets. And then look at people and what they're talking about. You can find like-minded people. If people are talking about a new tactic on front-end design or a new code structure or a type of wine or a law issue that you're excited about, you can just see people in their natural environment. Then click on their profile. See if they have a link on their profile, which almost everybody does. Usually it's probably going to land on their personal blog or some other page, maybe their LinkedIn. And from there, contact them. And literally, you know, every website or LinkedIn has an email or a phone number or something of that nature. But I think from finding something in a tweet that compels you to reach out to that person, to you actually reaching out to that person and say, hey, are you interested in a job? 3 out of 5 of those people may write back and say, no, I've got my own thing. I'm a freelancer. But 2 out of 5 might say, yeah, I'm interested. Now you've vetted them in their natural environment. And I think it's a very efficient way to go instead of a bullcrap resume or some propped up landing page to have somebody hired. I like natural environments. Twitter happens to be the most natural of all.
What role does internal culture play in a company's success?
Internal culture is religion. Let me just say that again. It's the religion. I mean, you know, and you know, and no matter where you sit on the religion issue, you know that people will blindly do anything because of their religion, all right? Or what they most believe in, or what inspires you. There's a lot, you know, I don't want to just pick on one thing, but I mean, it's the whole damn thing, guys. I mean, I don't know. I don't understand how anybody runs a company that has more than 2 employees that doesn't understand that the culture of that thing is the entire kit and caboodle. People get inspired to work harder, smarter, better, care more about your business if you care about them first. And the way you create that caring for you first is by creating a culture. As a matter of fact, one of the interesting things at VaynerMedia, because we're so big, that I didn't realize really as much at Wine Library, though even as I'm saying this right now, it's popping back in my head. I think of culture a lot of time clearly as the CEO and the leader and the operator as what they're willing to do for the logo, right? Or for me. What I've been blown away by as the culture's gotten stronger and stronger at VaynerMedia is how much they do things for their coworkers. They do it more for them than they do it for me or the logo. They don't want to let down the, and it makes sense, right? It's the person you're in the trenches with. I'm up in the sky, right? You're there, Gary, you got your book. You know, this is the people you're in day in and day out. You're going to war with them. They're your teammates. And the great thing about culture is when you've got a lot of people that care, they drag other people that are indecisive or kind of in the middle into caring more. And then you've got everybody caring and it just kind of self-populates an incredible atmosphere and culture. And so, I mean, unless you're creating the greatest product ever in your space, I don't think it's really easy for a business to be successful in the long term, 5 to 10 years, without a very solid, at least palpable, you know, I call it middle class to upper middle class culture, because people won't want to stay, and talent is the game. People are the game. And so I think it's very important. It's something that's come natural to me right from the beginning of my career. It's something that I've expanded on more and more. It's something I want to triple down with even more because I think it is the indicator of outcomes for all types of businesses, whether 5 people or 5,000.
What's your best time management tip?
My number one tip is to hire another person to be the czar of your time. That was a little fun thing to say czar because I come from Russia, blah, blah, blah. I think that too many people try to save money on an assistant and try to get apps, the newest app on your iPhone that's going to make you so efficient with your time, and Evernote and Google Calendar and Mailbox and all these things. I think that the number one investment you can make if time is important to you is other human beings to save you time. The value I take on people that provide me time is extraordinary. And so, I mean, I'm even debating having 2 assistants. It's a real conversation in my mind right now. DeMeo, if you're listening to this before that actually happened, don't worry, let's talk about it. So, you know, I think time is super important, becoming more important because we live in a 24/7 world now where we're getting pounded every minute, not just 9 to 5. And I think the number one hack is, even though you might not be ready to afford it, getting an assistant. I'd rather you, if you're a solo practitioner entrepreneur right now, get a full-time assistant, not make as much money this year taking home, because I know the following year you'll make much more because you'll be doing much smarter stuff because the assistant will be tracking your time better. You'll be more efficient. It's insane what happened to me when I went to an assistant. Insane. I became 7 times the man I was operationally and business-wise.
What do you look for when hiring creatives?
So this is a very specific question to the advertising agency world, though creatives live everywhere. And so we have them at Wine Library. We're a wine shop. But I think this is pretty hardcore agency question, which is great. I love running mine. Creatives are interesting to me because I am creative, but I'm also practical and I'm a salesman. A lot of our creatives are completely off the spectrum of like just super unbelievably creative and talented. And I'm looking for that. The truth, though, is I am trying to teach them a lot more practicality. To me, it's, you know, it's art and science, right? It's numbers and it's colors. That's how I like to say it. So I think with creatives, I'm trying to find people that first respects the consumer more than trying to achieve their artistic goal, right? You have too many creatives that always wanted to do X and they don't care if it sells the bubble gum or it raises money for the NGO or helps elect the mayor. They just always wanted to do a 360 degree video from flying in the air with color, you know, and so practicality is something I'm looking for. At the same token, real talent. I mean, creatives are truly not scalable. They have to be creative and come up with random ideas and try things and fail. And people that are very comfortable in their own skin while respecting the consumer first, the platform they deliver the content on second, and then the client's ambition third, and then their own artistic wants and needs fourth. I think way too many creatives have that completely in reverse to the way I just laid it out.
Hello, this is Benjamin Israel Lazarus of Rebel Communications. Here's my question for the Ask Gary V book. Gary, do you drug test your employees? Why or why not?
This is so funny. We don't. I don't have a really great answer on this. I don't have any big political stance on drugs in America. I don't even really know how to, you know, this is funny that Steven made the book or made the show. Probably I was in a funny mood and wanted some random questions to break up the monotony of the show. We don't. You know, I mean, if we had to or legally or something that I would. It doesn't really drive me one way or the other. I'll tell you this. People's behavior on things that are more politically charged like this are far less interesting to me than what I care about. And their interaction day to day with their fellow employees and the quality of their work. And, you know, obviously I don't want somebody who's amazing and then doing very dark things that I don't know, but it's just, I don't know. I don't, you could probably tell my demeanor if you're listening. It's just not something that's really top of mind. So the answer is no, practically. And that's what I got for you.
Hey everyone. This is Sean Burrows, founder and chief executive intern at Enliven Media Group. And here's my question for the Ask Gary V book. Gary, when running a company or providing marketing services for a VaynerMedia client, how do you segment out sales, marketing, and business development? All three disciplines overlap so much, and the waters can get really muddy when one or more of those areas are clearly lacking and the others are strong.
Tremendous fun for me to answer this question because this is a very nerdy business question. Let me go backwards for people that are not as deep in their careers or don't think about it this way. Sales, marketing, and business development. These are different tactics to make one thing happen, a transaction, right? And so if you're marketing, one could argue that the Ask Gary V show is a marketing engine for VaynerMedia because if somebody who wants services sees a great answer to a question, they come in. So that's one way to look at it. Then there's business, you know, then there's a sales team, right? There's Ari who goes out and tries to make business happen and say, hey, XYZ company, you should work with VaynerMedia. There's business development, which is a version of sales, but can be more about doing conferences or networking or things of that nature. So, you know, to me, first of all, we're in a very interesting part because I sit on all three in my company. As a CEO, you could be a lot of things. You could be a salesman and saleswoman. You could be a marketer. You could be a financial former CFO that just knows how to run the numbers. I'm a sales, marketing, and business development savant. I'm a beast. Let's go with beast. Forget savant. I'm a sales, marketing, and business development beast. So the biggest problem in my company is that even the other people that are involved in these categories, boy, do I suffocate them. I'm such a big part of it. So I'm not the right guy to answer this question, by the way. I'm not kidding because I love it so much. I'm so deeply ingrained. I'm probably the right guy for a lot of you, all you guys and girls that are meddling too much in this world. And I get it. Every time I take a step back, it doesn't go as well. Every time I do, it does do as well. So, you know, it's tough to stay away from if it's the thing that you're great at. When I think about breaking them down into three categories, I'm not worried about one being stronger than the others. You comp that way. Like if I literally was hands off and those three divisions were run by three different people and one represented 20% of the action and one represented 60% of the action and the other one represented 20% of the action, I would comp that way. I would make sure that 60% leader was making more money, got more attaboys, attagirls, was put in a position to succeed, got more resources, I bet on more. I don't think this is complicated. I actually think that people are more emotional about making them. There is no 33, 33, 33% thing on this. And I think that's where your energy is, Sean. Who gives a crap as long as you're hitting your numbers? I mean that. And it may sound weird. One could argue, what do you mean, Gary? That's not the only thing. And you're right, it's not. But to me, it's a net-net game. And then you're just trying to plop up everything. Like, I'm not going to be crippled if my events person stinks and the events aren't driving to any business. If I'm getting to my goal, I'm in parallel trying to get to my goal and trying to prop up the events person or fire the events person. Like, you're a business person, make the decision. So to me, I watch them separately and I adjust accordingly. It's like flying a plane while fixing it, right? I'm driving towards my success. I'm not going to be emotional if one thing's, now if they're all lagging and you're not hitting your numbers, that's a different story. I just haven't been in that position because of my micromanagement of it. If you're in that spot, well, then you got to fix it all. You got to get involved in it. I mean, just like anything else, if there's a leak, you got to plug it. And so I just want to make sure that people don't get romantic about, oh, they have to all be in synergy. Like, way too many people have this romantic way they want it to be. This is one of them. They want all these things to get along and work perfectly and clearly break out into a third, a third, a third. That's stupid. It really is stupid. And I don't use that word lightly. It's a silly thing to do. I don't like you stupid. You know, it's just a silly thing to aspire towards. Aspire to the net goal and try to make each of the individual units be the best they possibly can. Then everything will work itself out.
When transitioning to a new project management role, how do you maintain high standards with your team while still keeping projects on time and on budget?
Ears are greater than mouths. That's how you address this. Way too many people in project management want to dictate and talk because they feel the power of that role. And because the buck stops with them at some organizations, they are empowered. And what they're not doing enough of is using their ears. You need to communicate to all the people you're working with to find out strengths, weaknesses, thoughts, problems, processes. This is an absolutely easy thing. Project management, similar to management in the way that project management, I guess I think of it as business management, but project management's a micro thing of the overall thing, is the same religion at the top level of a CEO. You've got to listen. You've got to listen and talk. You've got to listen first, then talk. Talk to allow you to listen more. It's all good old-fashioned communication. Way too many people are just dictating the way they want it and do it this way, and they're not using empathy, and they're not giving a opportunity for a real collaborative situation to happen, which is the only way these things work.
How do you prioritize which project to execute first?
The way I look at this is predicated on the two biggest. The biggest fire that I have to take care of, otherwise the house burns down. Or two, where's the biggest upside, right? So I think you're pulling like a rubber band really hard on each side. What's the biggest vulnerability and what's the biggest upside for growth? The best defense and the best offense. And I'm really running on those two at all times. And then, because this is interesting, I've never gotten this deep on this, then I'll probably go 2, 3, and 4 on the left side. I'm using my hands right now on the offense. It probably goes 1A, 1B, biggest upside opportunity, biggest fire. Number 2, 3, and 4 are biggest upside. Number 5 is fire. Number 6 is upside. Number 7, 8, 9 is fire. So you see what I'm doing here, right? At the height, the two biggest are equal. After that, it's more upside offense than defense.
How can agencies make staff meetings more productive?
And obviously the person asked agencies, but this is for everybody in any business all over the world. Meetings are the worst. I hate them. They're dangerous. They're killing people. It's bad. It's inefficient people that don't want to get things done, just pandering to the process instead of the results. I'm an anti-meetings guy, even though I'm in them all day long. I'm just in 5-minute meetings, 7-minute meetings, 11-minute meetings, and they all are the same meetings that are 30, 40, and 50 in so many other places. So number one, biggest rule, biggest takeaway from the book, possibly for so many of you, go home right now and cut every meeting in half. You will be unbelievably stunned. Let me tell you what's going to happen. If I gave 5 people 2 hours to rake my leaves in my yard, 5 young kids trying to make a buck, rake my leaves with 5 of them, it would take them 2 hours. If those same kids came back and there was 2 of them and I gave them 2 hours to do it to get the money, they'd get it done. People just conform into the time when they're not most motivated. And most people aren't most motivated at all times. So by cutting a meeting in half, You're basically forcing them to get 60 minutes in their mind worth of stuff done in 30 minutes. Or reverse it, they just realize that only took 30 minutes and everything else they were doing was lallygagging or around a bush, or it just forces efficiency. Restraints create creativity. 140 characters for Twitter created a new language. Everyone's like, it couldn't be done. Of course it could be done. It's a requirement. It's a, what if there was 29 hours in the day? You get more done. We just know a world where there's only 24. What if I told you, oh, weird, we're changing it to 29? I'd be pumped, by the way. But, you know, that's what I mean. Lines in the sand. Cut meetings in half. Nothing will change except you will get more shit done.
What's one question you ask in interviews?
You know what's funny? I'm going to give a couple of different answers. The one question, and by the way, I have no idea why I asked this question. And I'm just going to give a shout out to my baby sister Liz and my baby bro AJ, because it must be I love them so much. I ask everybody about their siblings, if they have any, about them. I don't know even what, I don't have some master plan that it, like, oh, if you're a middle child, like, I don't think about it. Like, I don't quantify, oh, they're a middle child, they're going to be better at this. There's no master plan. It's just there. What I'm really doing in interviews is trying to find out what that person's North Star is. We've talked about this earlier in the book. I'm trying to reverse engineer their current KPI. Key performance indicator. What's driving them? Their current want. Is it the money? Did they come here for the title? Did they watch 500 episodes of the Ask Gary Vee show and want to just be around me? Do they live around the corner and it's a better commute and all things are equal? Did they see a cute guy on Instagram that works here and they want to hook up? Like, I really don't care. I just want to know what it is, and I'm spending time in these interviews trying to figure that out. I'm also talking a lot, more than I should, but I'm trying to give them a very quick indicator of what they're walking into so they can bow out if they're not going to be part of this culture. So those are the things that I'm doing in interviews.
What would you do if all 600 employees quit VaynerMedia?
I don't talk about this often, but the number one fear I have in business, besides the health and well-being of, like I talked about earlier, the core team, is big lotteries. So we just lived through a Powerball that was like $1 billion. I am secretly petrified that every employee teams up and buys a lotto ticket and they win, and then I have to deal with that. So the reality is that I don't think it's ever going to happen to me. The only way it does if it is with Powerball. I have a funny way of believing that I would turn that into a big media event and somehow make more money anyway, because I'm that kind of character. But the truth is, if it happened for any other reason than Powerball, the first thing I do is go into a cave and figure out what made 600 people want to leave my business. I've clearly gone awry to a level that I wasn't self-aware about. Now, to get a little bit more practical, here's another real truth. I'd secretly be pumped, because I would rebuild it and stick it to all 600 of those employees. Like, I'd get very, very, first I'd get sad and confused, and then I would get competitive as fuck. That's right, keep the fuck in there. I'd get competitive as fuck and try to destroy, because I'd have to assume they went and started their own thing, da-da-da-da-da. I would completely punch, I would beat the crap out of them. I know that's weird. Listen, I know I talked to, look, listen, the person that I've probably been most aggressive with in my life is my brother AJ, who I love the most, because we play sports against each other. And that's where I go into the only other zone that I have, like business. When I have, I love you when we're off the field. I used to get mad when players shook hands after a game because I'd be so upset. But I'm like, wait a minute, I'm a hypocrite. I'm that guy. I'll beat your face in for 60 minutes. But after, I hope your family's well. I'm glad you're healthy. I'm glad you didn't get hurt. You know what I mean? I'm that. That's who I am in business. Like, I know that was aggressive, and I love these 600 like you would not believe, but if they want to go against me, I'm ready. I want to go.
Is the lack of chairs in your office a part of instilling the hustle in your employees?
This is what's fun about, like, going around the office and people can see from the videos what's going on. No, but damn it, I wish it was, because that would be a brilliant hack. No, I just think that, I don't know. We have 450 23-year-olds that are very comfortable sitting on the floor and bean bags and standing desks. And we just have a different kind of culture. Nothing super thought out. Maybe we're growing too fast and we can't order chairs fast enough. Maybe chairs take up space and we're running out of space. No master plan. Funny observation. probably brings a dynamic to our culture. I'll tell you one thing, and I think anybody who's watched the show and has seen it, we have a very dynamic culture. There's a lot of us close to each other. People that come from the outside are always commenting on it. I like that people sit on each other's laps, not in an inappropriate way, but, like, you know, I just love that cramped feeling, you know, picnic tables and phone booths and just, you know, lack of chairs is probably, might be somebody else's brainchild. It's just not mine.
Hey, it's Adam Grant. I'm a Wharton professor, author of Give and Take and Originals, and decidedly not a Jets fan. I'm thrilled to be reading the next 10 questions in the Ask Gary V book. When hiring for a team, is it better to bring in specialists or someone who can wear multiple hats?
Adam, thank you so much. Adam, an amazing author. You know, I would return the Ask Gary V book and buy one of his. He's just amazing. And I know you know that I'm joking. That was a psychology move to make sure you never do that. But definitely check out Adam. You know, I'm a multiple hats kind of guy. I like it. I think utility players are massively important. To me, when given the option, I will go with the multiple hats person because it gives me flexibility. I'm the kind of head coach that wants to be able to move the second baseman to short if he is capable of doing that. I value specialists quite a bit. I'm not looking for my starting ace pitcher to go play outfield. Get it? So you see where I'm going here? Depending on the position, you know, I don't need my CFO doing anything other than being the greatest mathematician around finances that she or he can be. But I think for a lot of positions, multiple hats matter. Plus, I like grooming and mentoring, and it's very important for me to keep giving opportunities to people, so people that have multiple hat DNA will continue to be challenged and excited at VaynerMedia, at Wine Library, at Vayner Capital, at anything else I do in my life. So I probably sway a little bit towards that, knowing how dynamic I want the next 40 years of my life to be. At the same token, when there's specific things for VaynerMedia that we need for video or this, that, and the other thing, I can get very narrow and very specific. I think the job and the ambition of the task at hand, if it's local, we need to be able to do this video thing. You got to go specialist. But if it's global, we just need the best talent in this building that can be cultivated for many other things. I want to go with multiple hats.
When faced with two equally qualified candidates for one position, how do you choose?
No such thing as equally qualified. There's no such thing. It's snowflakes. That person that thinks that is not decisive. I'm being hardcore here. I think people use this as an excuse to hedge. There's no such thing. I mean, there's nobody that's exactly the same. Remember, if you're making the decision, you're the judge and the jury. Step up, be a judge, make a call. In the couple of times where things were not crystal clear to me, which they are 99% of the time, I've hired both. I've given a profit and I've put one in one place and one in another because I'm just always growing and I can afford it. You may not be able to do that. You may just have the overhead for a $13 an hour employee. So pick one and stop crying over spilled milk. And if you made the wrong call because the person sucked, call back the other person 4 months later after you figured it out and try to have them come in. By the way, I've done that. Sometimes both of them sucked. 8 months later, neither one of them could do it. So, you know, again, way too much bantering and thinking and pondering and debating. Make calls and adjust after the fact. Speed trumps everything. Hey guys, this is Gary Vaynerchuk. I'm a huge, huge fan of Gary V. Big, big fan. And I've got to do a couple of these. Just two, I think, is right, right? That's right, just two of the... Oh, just one. Let's keep this all. I like the improv of it. I know you don't love it as much, but I got... You love it? Thank you. Here we go. What three values do you hold highest in life? Gary, thank you so much for asking the question. I also am an enormous fan of yours. There's a huge love affair. I think you're the best. You're literally the best person I know besides myself. Let's get into them. And there's three that really, and there's really four that really, really are at the top of the game. Number one, word is bond. We talked about this quite a bit with my dad, you know, kind of spitting on the hand. I'm just so thankful. I, you know, it's funny. The next one will be gratitude. I'm grateful that my dad got a hold of me at the right moment and taught me that. It is absolutely the reason that I didn't go the full of shit route and manipulated everything and was just another kind of bottom feeder and made a couple million bucks doing different things. It just changed the course of my life. I value word. Now, here's what's ironic. My dad values you being honest to him in return. I don't. That's just the truth. I'm not crippled by you being word is bond to me. I value for me being word is bond to you. Next, let's go right into gratitude. I'm driven by this. When people ask me, What's that thing that drives you? It's gratitude. I'm grateful for the health and well-being, for the fact that I got to leave a communist country and came to a capitalist country, for the enormous gifts that I've been given, for the friends that were put into my life. I didn't make Brandon Warnke live in Clinton, New Jersey when I moved there and then became my best friend and now runs Wine Library. I didn't do that. The universe did that. I'm grateful for that in a big way. Number three, empathy. I'm a huge believer in this. I think it's the driver to my salesmanship. I'm so grateful. I'm just going to keep meta-ing this whole thing because it's all meta. I'm grateful that I have it. It helps me navigate. It makes me understand. It keeps me calm and patient. My balance comes in understanding everybody else's point of view on things. I use it in great, great ways. And I think it's very important. And if you have it, please expose it more. I think too many people don't realize its greatness. And I'm going to end with this. Number four, patience. It's the biggest reason most of you that are listening aren't winning. When I audit the Vayner Nation, you Vayniacs, when I audit you, and I watch you so carefully and you know it, you lack patience. You want it to happen now. You're in pain. You're in envy. You're in want. You're in need. And it doesn't allow you to be as patient as you need to be. If I could just convince you how much longer your life was going to be, how much more was to come, you would be willing to punt a year or two or three of patience and allow yourself to really put yourself in a position to succeed. Watching so many of you over the last several months and years start to deploy just a little patience and get results and then go back into bad habits and try to go too fast has been disheartening. And so I really, really, really want to pound this home. Please understand that life is long. Please do the right thing. Doing the right thing is always the right thing. Patience is so incredibly important. And I'm the most hyper and energy and all this, but my patience is my beacon to success.
When you work on projects with clients, how much is done online, for example, via Skype, and how much in person?
You know, it's funny. The mix on this is just the ebb and flow, serendipity, chance, oftentimes predicated on the client itself. Is the client looking to do more stuff in person or not? I don't have a system. I'm very willing to be inefficient with my biggest asset, which is time, for my clients because I accepted their business. And even if they might not be the highest paying anymore, things of that nature, I've made a mental commitment to them being a client. And so I can, tomorrow morning I'm flying to Knoxville, Tennessee. So wiping out the whole day, but that's my client and they want me there and I'll be there. And if they want to be on Skype, cool. And I love in-person stuff for a tech scalable guy. I like email. I like it all. As long as the client is getting what they want, I can get rid of a client. So while they're my client, I'm going to give it to them the way they want it. And if I don't want to be delivering it that way, if they're asking me to meet every minute, every day, always, and I don't see value in that, well, I'm a big boy. I'm allowed to say, listen, this doesn't work for me. And they say, well, Gary, we bought VaynerMedia for you. I'm like, well, that's not what we sold you because we've never sold that to anybody. And two, sorry, this isn't 1937 arranged marriages. Like, we're all big boys and girls here. So I feel like I'm going to deliver for my client the way they want it anytime and in any way that they want to communicate.
If you were the owner of the Jets, what would you do to turn around the team and make them a Super Bowl contender?
Look, this is my life goal. And I've been very fortunate. I've gotten close to some NFL owners and closest to Stephen Ross, the owner of the Miami Dolphins, my hated arch rival. That's right, Steve. Take that. He's my business partner in VaynerMedia, my fund. And he's, one of the most successful businessmen in United States history. He's just a beast. And his football team has not done well under his watch. And that's very easy for me to understand because in the NFL, you have a salary cap. The NFL draft is a crapshoot, and it's the most important part to be successful. I already complained about the Patriots getting lucky in the sixth round with Tom Brady. So I could run them as a great business, and I would. The Jets would be more popular in New York than the Giants under my watch because I'm a great marketer, and I would figure that out. But a product on the field, I would put the best football minds in the best position to succeed, but I would also recognize there's injuries. The NFL draft is absolutely a crapshoot. No matter how good you are in business, you can't outspend everybody because there's a cap. And so kudos to the luck of the Steelers and the Patriots and the Giants. And just, I love when everyone's like, aren't these great organizations? Yes and no. I mean, I think at the end of the day, we've seen time and time again that the product on the field has a lot to do with a lot of things. And I don't have the blindness to think that I can control it. Now, I can make decisions around people, and I think I'm really good at that. And honestly, very honestly, I do think I'm going to be very successful because I do think I'll be able to evaluate the key general manager and presidents and things of that nature, scouts that will succeed. So that's the biggest control I can do. Be a great manager, put the best players in a position to succeed. When I say players, I mean my executives that are making decisions, and then pray for non-injuries and pray for a little Russell, you know, Wilson or Tom Brady moment where you really hit pay dirt late and away you go.
Would you support Vayner employees who wrote their own books and curated their own content streams and personal brands?
You're damn right I would. And I already have. Just ask Jason Donnelly at VaynerMedia. Google him up. Helped him. Gave him awareness. I've said it earlier, so I think we're going into repetition, but I'll try to find some different angles for you guys. I am not going to hold anybody back. I mean, I'm not in this world where I want to have 70,000 slaves that are building the Gary Vaynerchuk name. If you can do it, go do it. If you want it, go get it. Like, to me, I have no interest in anybody ever saying that I did something in my best interest that was not in their best interest. So there's always more employees. I mean, we get 6,000 applications a day. So it's very easy for me to support the people that have already brought so much valuable time and effort to me.
How do you push your team beyond their best?
You lead by example. I think one of the things that people have sniffed out that has been intriguing for me, I'm starting to just quantify. I think a lot of people have realized, oof, Gary's way more successful than maybe he should be. I'm not kidding. Meaning they can see that I'm willing things to victory, that I'm really tripling down on my strengths, that I'm wildly willing to punt on my weaknesses and outsource and admit and all these other things. And I think leading by example is one definite thing. Like the more I'm winning, the more they're winning. They're finding their balance in it. I think the other thing is it's so sad, but a lot of my employees did not have parents that instilled self-esteem, you know, or had a lisp or a learning disability, or grew up in a tough town, like environments or things that didn't allow them to be as self-confident as I am. And I think one of the absolute North Stars of driving a team to greater success than they even believe in themselves is to instill self-esteem into them the way my mom did to me. I think positive reinforcement. I think not dwelling on the losses. One of the things I spend very little time on. Hey, one thing we didn't talk about. I got to kind of deploy a little bit of humility on the way I celebrate victories. There's something we didn't talk about, which is the way I deal with defeats. So for all my employees that I apologized to earlier for not celebrating huge wins, now I'm going to say, give me a fat kiss on my cheek for the way we deal with losses, because I never impose it on you. I always put it on my back. You don't feel the loss. So you don't feel the wins as much, maybe, but you're definitely not, you're almost not even feeling the losses. We almost have a fake environment where people don't think they can do anything wrong to get fired because I'm putting so much on my back. And so I think that's another way. I think way too many of my managers, even now, and I'm trying to weed them out, are nitpicking and making their people feel bad. It's got to be the other way. It's blind honey. I'm telling you, it's blind honey. Now, there needs to be ramifications if somebody's completely lost, but I'd much rather kind of err on the side of overconfidence, self-esteem, rah-rah, than, oh, this isn't going to work, or you haven't done a good job, or we're not going to win this pitch because, you know. So I think the best way to get the best out of people is to make it taste delicious, to put people in a good mood, to make it feel like it's going to happen, to blindly believe in victory, because what's the downside of that? As long as you have self-awareness that you're doing that, well, then you're not caught off guard.
Hey, Vayner Nation, it's Justin Brook, founder of I Am Scalable, a meat and potatoes blog for direct response marketers. And here's my question for the Ask Gary V book. How do you hold your employees accountable, aka actually do work and get results? I mean, it's not like you can send them to their room and firing them still leaves you with no work done.
This is something so many of us deal with. right? I mean, this is an incredibly interesting question. First and foremost, it's company culture. I know we've been dwelling on it. Now you're starting to realize why I care about it so much. I think when the culture is really strong, people feel guilt on not delivering to their fellow employees, like I mentioned earlier, or to the logo, or to me. So culture sits at the top. I think another thing is communication. You know, I think it's mass, and this is something I've done very poorly in my career and I'm still working on, which is because I'm positive honey blind, I'm not giving critical feedback. AJ was much better at that. Kelly McCarthy, an early executive of my company, much better at that. You know, have they historically gone further than I wanted? Probably. I feel like sometimes we go too far with critical feedback, which leads to bad culture, but I think critical feedback matters. Like, hey, you didn't do that well. Hey, you didn't do that well. Because now you're building up at least context for people and you're not blindsiding them when the answer to the third thing is, firing. I mean, I think one of the things that you can do, one thing you'd be stunned about is your A and B players are willing to do more work if they're compensated. That's how they got there. So I would be fine firing a couple people and then taking some of that money and giving it to an A player to take up that work because they're capable. If you think about it in this terms, an A player, they use 100% of their energy. You fired people, they were doing 20% of their energy. Two people, that's 40%, right? Two people at 20. You can give that to the A player because a lot of times she's capable of doing 140. And all of a sudden you've saved money and you get all the same things done. So there's that. I think the other thing is to always create a system that is not at the mercy of an employee. Meaning, it's funny how you ended this, which leaves no one to do the work. I don't even understand that. Meaning, I've always built things, even when it was just me and one or two other people, that there was backups, which was normally me, and I would just outwork it then. There's no reason to keep around losing players. You'll never win in the end. All you're doing is really just holding your breath to the inevitable anyway. And so, the quicker you can cut the cancer, the quicker you're moving forward.
The dress code at VaynerMedia is clearly casual. Do you think dress affects professionalism or performance?
And I went with the hardcore silence there just to make my point, and now I'm back. I do not. I think everybody should do their thing. I'm not mad at anybody who works at a law firm that has to wear suits because there's a perceived notion that the clients would want to see that and it feels more professional. And by the way, perception is reality. So cool, you do you. I mean, for me, it has never registered. I'm not worried about it. I don't know what else to say. Like, that to me is an old school, non-real thing anymore. But that's because we have a new age, kind of young, hip, beat kind of company. I'm sure we probably look the part, right? I'm sure nobody would want to come into a social media agency and see everybody in suits. But at the same token, everything stems from the top. You know, I would say that Wine Library's dress code was poor compared to what it should have been for high-end wine selling. I think every business takes the personality of its leader. I am not the hardest core dress code guy, and I think that trickles down to my organization. I think most organizations should be authentic to the leadership, the CEO, and what they're trying to accomplish, but I definitely don't think it affects professionalism or performance. I don't think a lawyer is crushing it any better because she's in a suit versus sweatpants.
What are your thoughts on employing friends?
I'm a huge believer in this. I mean, both of my companies, Wine Library and VaynerMedia, were heavily built on friends. My best friend Brandon was a major cog and important part of Wine Library's growth. I tried to get one of my best friends from college, Rob Muse, to take a job. He didn't, but it was my ambition. VaynerMedia started with five of AJ's best friends in the world. So I'm a big believer, as long as you believe in meritocracy. Let me explain. The reason VaynerMedia works right now is those five best friends are all ranked in different places right now. Some of them are the seventh most compensated, most important person in the company. Others are 143. We've allowed meritocracy to take over. You start with friends, but then it becomes business, right? And now that takes a lot of effort on both ends. That takes effort on mine and AJ's end. That takes a lot of effort on Brandon and Marcus's end. And so I think that as long as you have that conversation up front, which is, hey, man, I'm going to start this. I want you to be a part of it. But just because you're my homie doesn't mean you're going to be my right-hand guy, right? Hey, gal, you know, just because you're my sister doesn't mean you're going to be number four. You may be number nine. You may be number 17. And I've done this with brother-in-laws and relatives. I mean, it's just meritocracy has to rule or you will undermine everybody around it and they feel like they can never be higher than your friends, which will then never allow them to drive or work hard enough or be ambitious, and they'll always think that you are playing a kind of vigged game that doesn't make it interesting. It just takes so much passion out. You have to deliver on meritocracy if you want to be with friends, but I'm all for it. Just have that meritocracy conversation up front.
Once you recognize your weaknesses, should you keep working on improving them or delegate?
You know, I'm a delegate guy on this. I just am. I think there's not enough time in the world to work on your weaknesses for the minimal returns it gets, because I think we have a lot of DNA in us. The end. I'm even more emphatic on this answer in the audiobook than I am in the written book, and even where I was 6 months ago. Look, I think there's probably some upside to, it's incremental, right? There's probably some upside. I mean, if you can't read, maybe you want to learn how to read. Maybe. I mean, like, literally, I'm not even sure. But, like, there's probably some, I guess I look at it this way. Give it 3 months of, like, trying to make it better, and I bet you'll see, like, okay, like, I got a little better at organization. I got a little better at this. I got a little better at that. But in business, I'm a, you know, in health, you should figure that out, because that's your life. But in business, I really think delegating is the way to go. You'll go faster. There's other people that are naturally great at it. Players in positions to succeed. I believe in that so much. And so I would be much more into delegation. Way too many self-help books. Way too much Americana pushing fix everything you're bad at. The system tells you to fix things that you're bad at, because there's a lot of money in telling people to fix things that they're bad at that they can never figure out. I mean, I see this with entrepreneurship. You know how many of you are part of masterminds paying $500 a month, $5,000 a month, $50,000 a month, part of business masterminds, and you'll never be a good entrepreneur? And that person knows it, and that's what their business is living on? That's why I'm so against a lot of that kind of stuff. Delegation.
Do you have any tips on delegation?
Sure. Here's one that a lot of people don't tell you. 99% of the stuff that you deal with every day doesn't matter. When you wrap your head around that 99% of the, this is a real answer, guys, 99% of the stuff that I'm dealing with every day doesn't matter, which means that as long as it's being taken care of at an 80% level that I would have taken care of it, then that's fine, because it didn't matter, remember? So I think that that's the big key. It's not about, well, it had to be done right. Did it even matter? And so I see this all the time with pitch decks that we're not going to win the business anyway, or signage on a wine that we're only going to sell one case of, and we're going to make $6 on the whole case. Like, why did you spend an hour on the sign? Well, someone once told me, do everything like the best way, because that reflects on everything that you do. Just not real. Meaning, it's a real saying, and I get it. I get the energy. But when are we going to deploy common sense and practicality to everything? Because that's what I like to do. I like to just look at everything for what it is. Not everything is some grand IOSO religion at the highest mountain. We bought one case of wine. We're not getting it back in. We're going to make $6 profit. And you, $90,000 a year wine expert, spent 4 hours making a perfect sign for it. And oh, by the way, it's a sought after wine. It's going to sell out tomorrow. It's just not right. It's not right when you have 900 cases of something else that you're going to make even more margin on, that you're going to have, like, that's not right. Practicality does matter. And so the quickest way to become a better delegator is to recognize most of the things you're doing aren't that important. You want to think they're important because it makes you feel good. And that, my friends, is an unlock that will really matter for the rest of your career if you understood what I said.
Hi, this is Greg Pesci, founder and CEO of Spera. And here's my question for the Ask Gary V book. What are some of the key challenges facing freelancers today, and what tools can they use to overcome them?
Look, the freelance market is a very competitive one. People are, you know, realizing now more than ever that there's a supply and demand issue on freelancing, meaning there's so many people that could do these tasks. As web tools are being created to discover these people, the prices come down. It's just like any marketplace, eBay. In the beginning of eBay, Star Wars figures, rare video games, they were more expensive because less people knew about eBay and they were posting less, and the market was growing quickly. There were supply and demand issues at hand. With freelance, the biggest issue right now is no matter what these websites are, it's kind of like Airbnb, right? Like, those prices are going down. It's better for the consumer. It's better for me to hire freelance now because there's so many people that can raise their hand and say me, because there's so many websites that make it discoverable. Information is at a fingertip. You know, I think the biggest challenge is separating yourself and differentiating yourself. So I think it's more of a marketing tool thing. I actually think one of the things that freelancers should be doing way more of is self-promotion and really not just having a resume on their website, but doing more content creation, doing all the things we talk about in Jabber Jab Right Hook, Medium and Snapchat and Facebook and Twitter and Tumblr and Instagram. I think it's marketing. And I think the tools that they should use are actually classes, hiring somebody to market them. If they're not a good, you know, a lot of artists are very bad at kind of being salespeople. I don't think this is an answer that's going to help a freelancer like where I think you were going with it, which is like, you know, managing your money's tough. So go start using tinktinktink.com and you'll save time on paying your taxes. Those are all commoditized. If you really want to talk about what's going on with freelancing right now is supply and demand issues. Technology is making it easier for the market to find people, which means they'll find more people, which means the cost goes down. You need to differentiate yourself. I think the tools that they should be investing in is the tools at a holistic level to separate themselves from the pack in a personal brand environment, because that's what you're selling. You're selling yourself when you're a freelancer.
The first question, I need to hire an office assistant, but those sales are great. I don't have the capital to hire anyone. Got any creative ideas?
I don't know what Jack Welch, most iconic CEO maybe in corporate America history, is doing by not introducing himself here. I don't know if he's playing some weird game where maybe either in a couple more questions he does identify himself, or he thinks he's that big time that he doesn't have to. But I know it's probably the third, which is he just got right into it and was very efficient. And so, Jack, I really appreciate you. I'm just kind of, your voice is also amazing. I'm sure everybody just enjoyed that. All right, let's get into it. Use your social capital. What do I mean by that? When you don't have money, you have other things. I mean, for example, bartering is way, way, way down in consumer and business behavior in our society. But I think I could hire an assistant for Wine Library by paying a person in wine. You have assets, or you'll give them exposure, or you'll give them opportunities that they never had before in doing things. For example, small companies, which a lot of you are, you might let somebody do the video editing because they want to be a video editor one day. That is so much more advanced than if they went to an agency and got paid minimum wage. And they won't be able to do the big stuff for 5 years. There's a lot of things that can compensate people besides money. I'm not kidding. We've gotten away from bartering, you know, 400 years ago or whatever it is now, right? But I actually think it has a chance of coming back, and I'm very fascinated by it. It's something I want to explore. I actually want to create the eBay bartering site of the world where you're just putting up stuff and people are just trading. I like trading. So believe it or not, I'm going a little weird here. Like, hire an intern that you don't pay, but you compensate in other ways. Exposure, experience, free stuff from your office that you do have. I don't know, like maybe you know Brandon Marshall, the Jets football player, like I do, and the person's the biggest Jets fan in the world, and you trade getting to meet Brandon Marshall for working with me for a summer. I mean, you could do anything. I think we've gotten way too many people that play by the school rules and don't think creatively, don't draw outside the lines. You have assets. Maybe you're willing to mow that person's lawn. I mean, there's just a million things you can do. And so don't be in this place where you're like, oh, I don't have the money to hire an assistant. More importantly, let's make sure we quantify don't have enough money. Don't have enough money or don't want to give up that much profit that goes directly in your pocket. This is where people don't make the one step backwards, three steps forward move. Way too many of you want to make 100K, 500K, 40K. Like, can you make 32K? Can you make 80K? Can you make 407K? And then deploy it against somebody who will allow you to make 600K the next year. And so investing in your future is something that a lot of people don't do because they want the short term. Well, I want to go on vacation, or they don't manage their money well at home. There's just a million variables here that can come into play as an entrepreneur or a business person.
They say you should hire slow and fire quick. How many chances do you give your staff?
I hire fast and fire slow-ish, but fast too. Like, I don't know. I mean, this is such a personal question. I've given some people a ton of I give most people too many. As a matter of fact, the biggest observation from my HR team, my executives, my brother, my dad, is that I don't fire fast enough. I've never loved it. This is probably the most hypocritical advice I give to people in the world. I talk about firing fast. I don't think I fire fast enough. I feel like I'm in a confession booth, so I might as well go there. I think you give chances predicated. It's kind of like sports. I know I use a lot of sports analogies. I'm sorry for everybody. But if you're into the arts, it's like a musician or an actor. You know, an actor, Robert Downey Jr., got a lot of chances. Talented as hell. right? Randy Moss got a lot of chances, talented as hell. You probably are giving people chances predicated on their talent because you can see it, right? We all hope. It's like girls that like Bad Boys. They're like, I can switch him. You know, a lot of times you can and a lot of times you can't. And so I would say that this is a personal question. I've run the gamut. One chance, seven chances. You know, it goes a lot of different ways. A lot of times it's based on how you feel about that person. And again, and I'm probably driving this home a lot, but actually I'm excited because I don't think I drive it home enough. It's on you. Like, you know, you're the judge and the jury. Remember that. That's what I always remember. I'm in charge of making the decisions.
Here's one. How do you motivate teams of remote workers without a payment incentive? So far, positivity and hustle are not producing results.
This one, you have to take the blame and really go right into communication. I mean, to me, I would over-communicate with the remote employees and find out what's not working. I mean, when things are not working, first I go into my cave mentally, because remember, it's like flying the plane and fixing it. I don't actually go into a cave. I got to still operate. I'm on the job. But I start pondering what's not working. And then you start asking questions. And you start asking questions in different ways, because sometimes people won't answer it. I start watching behavior on social media. I start asking questions of people that are close to it. You just start asking questions. And I think that you've got to have a conversation with the workers. They may just only be motivated by financial incentive. And so maybe hiring them in the first place was a mistake. So that's where I would go with. I don't think this is super hard. You just go into how can I help you.
Now, what does it take to work at VaynerMedia?
You know, this just comes down to the job you're interested in. I mean, if you're looking to be a community management entry-level employee, it takes gusto and fire and young passion and interest in the social media landscape. If you want to be somebody on the video team that's a hardcore editor, you've got to have skills and have done it for a long time. I think the one thing we're looking for is kind people, and we're trying to figure out how to do that, and we're doing a really good job with it. We love kind at VaynerMedia. Like, if you're a good gal, boy, you have a much better... It's unbelievable how kindness resonates with our process. But then you need the skills, and you need the hustle and the resume for certain things. It's a real kind of brouhaha of different things that can get you in the door. Chance, luck, timing. I mean, these are real things. Moments of need out of nowhere. Million variables, like any other business. But we're a fast-growing business, and so it's probably in some weird way easier to get into. One thing that won't work, and a lot of you have done this, is fronting. What I mean by that is so many of my fans have struggled to get jobs at VaynerMedia because they're pandering to quotes that I've said. I think they get nervous and they get excited. Like, we are not looking for anybody who, like, has read everything that I've said and, like, understands religion. We want to know you, not what you know about me or us. And so we're looking for, you know, the most authentic version of yourself. And it may or may not work, but we just need to know who you are. Like, that's really what we want to know. We want to know who you are.
What key factors should a millennial-owned branding company look for when hiring other millennials as it quickly scales?
Well, I think you look for other millennials that understand millennials. But I would also argue that you should look for people that are not millennials that know and understand millennials. If you're selling to millennials, you want people that know how to sell to millennials. That doesn't just come in the form of millennials. As a matter of fact, I would argue that most of the kids that work for me don't know how to sell to themselves, because they just don't know how to sell. Like, look at, what's his name? Lou Pearlman, that guy that went to jail, some fat old 60-year-old, 50-year-old white dude that understood what 14-year-old girls wanted. He wasn't a 14-year-old girl, but creating NSYNC and Backstreet Boys, he knew exactly what 14-year-olds wanted. And so I don't think they have to, I want to make sure this person and everybody that's listening, don't typecast. Like, you don't have to hire a 42-year-old mom to sell your product because you're targeting 42-year-old moms. You might be able to hire, I mean, I got a 25-year-old kid right now, guy, who's crushing on a 42-year-old mom brand because he's got the cadence. He's probably super in tune to his mom or, oh, I don't know, who knows? He's got it. So I've always been that way. I'm a 40-year-old dude, but I will crush minorities 13 to 20 on social media all day long because I understand them and I associate. And so, please at least make sure that you're not doing that. As far as what should you be doing with hiring them, let me be the champion for millennials. I'm so pissed at everybody's narrative about the millennials, that they don't work hard, that they're entitled. Old guy talk. Just, I walked in the snow 15 miles. This is old guy talk. Like, Millennials are fine. They're just as fine as anybody. As a matter of fact, they're smarter. Like, truthfully, they're smart. They're more information smart. They have an advantage. Look about how good it is for the millennials. The world changed where now 60-year-olds rely on them for technology, right? So they have more... Why are you mad at millennials, 60-year-old dude, when you're asking millennials for their advice because you know the world's gone more tech-savvy and they have the skills? Of course they're going to have more audacity and more respect for themselves if you're asking them, because when you, 60-year-old guy, were 25, they were just telling you to get the coffee. Like, this... Yeah, and yes, we have parents now who give eighth-place trophies and all... Yes, yes. And, I mean, there's good with bad. They're more in tune to their feelings. Cool. They want to take more trips. Awesome. They don't want to work as hard. Good for them. Shit. I'm pumped that millennials don't want to work as hard. More for me. Like, I mean, who cares? Anyway, misbranded generation. Branded by people who aren't of the generation, who are romantic about the way they came up, who didn't get lucky to be born in a time where technology created all these opportunities. Tough luck for all of us. But don't judge them.
Where would you start building a digital team in a traditional, you know, TV print agency?
In a silo, first and foremost. One of the biggest mistakes companies make is they try to integrate the Navy SEALs and the ninjas with the big army. You don't see America make Navy SEALs interact with a general Navy soldier. They do their own things. They've got their own things. So many businesses are like, let's integrate the digital people with the traditional people. It doesn't work. It's oil and vinegar, right? It's just not going to work. Give them their own P&L, profit and loss statement. Let them run their own businesses. Put them into a silo and let them do their thing while at least having an eye and a cadence to the traditional thing. You know, VaynerMedia, run by me inside of a big print and TV agency, would have been bad because everything out of my mouth is they're dead, they're dead. I'd have to respect and kind of soften my cell a little bit in that organization, which wouldn't have been good for me. I wouldn't have done that because I believe what I believe in, but plenty of people would for the money and for the whatever. So I think it has to run in its silo and it has to be protected by the board, the chairman, or the CEO. Because when you integrate them in, a lot of times the new kid, the old kid, doesn't want to let that happen. You know, if digital is growing at the expense of TV print and you're a TV print salesperson and your commissions are going down and you're not feeding your family and you're not going to the Jersey Shore as much and bad things are happening to you, you're not pumped for Sally. You're sad for yourself, which is why they need to be siloed.
When do you shift from hiring a freelancer to hiring someone full time?
Three things. Need. Like, crap, we just need more people, let's hire them. We know what this freelancer does, let's just do it. You fell in love with them. Holy crap, this is an unbelievable cultural piece. We don't exactly need it now, but I'll run a lower margin in the short term for bigger margin in the upside because they're going to come in and do great things for us. And the third weird one, they fell in love with you. And I've had this happen with Vayner, which makes me super happy. They love your place so much, you're not sold that they're number two yet, that they're so great and you fell in love. But anytime somebody falls in love with you, you have to take it seriously. And so those are the three scenarios. Now, that third one creates a vulnerability where you may have to let them go 6 months later and you don't want to break someone's heart. And so you want to be upfront. You want to say, look, you love this company so much you want to work here. I'm going to make a bet on you, but I got to be honest with you. I'm not sure this is the right fit. And if it's not working in 6 months, you have to be prepared for us not to be working together.
Is terminating the bottom 10% still a good idea? Even on a team of all-stars, someone has to be last.
This is a real hoot for all you hardcore business nerds because you know this is Jack's big principle, which made him really famous in corporate America and really drove a lot of results. It's a tough one. I don't know if I'm completely in Jack's school on this. Like, if I truly had all-stars and I could carry it to just force cutting the bottom 10% when it really was the bottom, you know, 6% because two people were all-stars and that's how the math worked out, I don't think cutting good talent is ever a good idea. And so now you may be a bad radar on what the bottom 10% is and isn't, and that's your vulnerability. And maybe Jack's point on that is right, right? Whereas if you're the vulnerability on your judgment, if you just do it blindly, there's scale in that and speed. And so it's an interesting debate. You know, the truth is I am a little different. And don't forget, I'm different because I grow and run hyper growth companies. I get involved and grow companies from 3 to 50, from 3 to 100. So Jack came in, it was a very big company. I think at that level, it probably makes more sense than for me, where continuity and speed are quite important. And I would actually argue that C and D players matter to my business because I watch a lot of my people and friends, and when I say my people, my investments, things I stay close to, cut people that they shouldn't, and then they're spending so much time on hiring, but their ship is flying, and now they're hiring, where the guy who was a C would have been fine for another year or two. So I'm actually, depending on the size of the business, in a weird disagreement, where I think you should keep more people than you think. Once you hit a big level, 100,000, 500,000, a million employee type stuff that GE and others have, that probably makes a lot more rational sense when you don't know everybody, when you're just going by reporting of managers reporting on managers. So it's an interesting debate. Again, at a 500 level like I have, I think you hold on longer. At a 400,000 person level like GE, it makes a lot more sense.
As a business grows, what is the best solution for documenting policy, procedure, and process so everyone's on the same page?
You know, I don't think any company has exploded to the moon because they had the greatest super tight handbook. You know, I think that growth companies should worry about culture and communication to drive what a handbook's supposed to do. You know, I mean, my policies are basically like, be a good human being. Next. You know, like, I think that when you, again, it's interesting to Jack's reading here, 10,000, 4,000, 12,000, 29,000. It's like anything else. Are you the same person? And should you parent a 3-year-old the same way you parent an 18-year-old? Of course not. And so I think way too many people try to instill 18-year-old rules on 3-year-old businesses. So for what I know about my audience, 90% of you should be more on the level of not giving a crap about your handbook for the first 5 to 7 years because you're running small, solo, or medium-sized businesses. You know, for the executives and some of the people looking for inspiration or thinking about leaving corporate America and going into solopreneur land that are listening to this right now, if you want to take something that you can take back to your place, yeah, that matters at 40,000 employees. Like, you just have to have scale of rules. You can't get to everybody. The culture is much more diluted. Once again, a very two different part answer depending on the size of your company.
How can efficiency and creativity better work together?
This is really tough. You know, creatives by nature are inefficient. You know, they need to go zen out and take a walk and, you know, go to outer space for an hour to really get there. I think they work better together when they're siloed and then have respect for each other. One of the things I'm spending a lot of time on at VaynerMedia is trying to make sure that art and science have equal respect for each other. Nobody's valued more. And that once they respect each other, everybody can do their own thing and they come together and find common ground. I actually think the best way to get creativity to work with efficiency better is to work on the relationship at the highest level of those individuals and those units to know that each of these things are a major part of the cog and working together matters.
Hi, my name is Steve Sadov, and I'm the former chairman and CEO of Saks and a friend of Gary's. And I'm excited to be reading the next questions in the Ask Gary V book. Thanks so much for having me. My business is completely digital. How important are real life meetings?
Steve, thanks so much. One of the great retail CEOs of a generation. A lot of fun to have you reading along. And I'm sure a lot of you have shopped at Saks Fifth Avenue. And so let's get right into this. I think that real life meetings are clearly important just for sanity. I mean, like, don't people like people? I think that any business and every business should do the same thing, which is reverse engineer exactly what they should be trying to accomplish and get done. If you feel that you can get every business thing done without having real life meetings, and that is not, you know, kind of controlling your upside, and that's what you want, and you can sit in a room and not interact with people from a business environment, then knock yourselves out. I do not believe that that is the case for most people, and I believe so much is human, and it's context, it's feeling. I mean, as somebody who's a huge digital advocate, I think people are sometimes surprised by how much real-life stuff I want to do, I do, I care to do, and don't use video conferencing and things of that nature. So, you know, that's me. I'm good at people stuff. I feel like being in the room helps me. Not being on the phone or being on Skype is a lot of times the reason I won something. And so that's on you, and you do you. If you're not good in a room and you know, then maybe you should sit in your house and try to do everything video conferencing and email style. So I think this is reverse engineering how you roll. Most importantly, it's also understanding that technology will never take the human element out of things. Humans are humans for a reason. It's always going to happen. As much as I think we're going to become robots, I don't think it's going to happen in the next 10 to 15 to 30 years. So I highly recommend the practicality of what the human upside brings to the table.
How do I keep my old employees from hazing my new employees?
This was a huge problem for me at Wine Library. I mean, literally in our prime, 5 years into my organization, I had a real core team. 2003 to 2007, that 4-year window. I apologize for anybody who's listening to this that came into Wine Library. Literally on your first day with no training, no onboarding. We didn't have any of that. We'd throw you out into the store to do whatever the hell you were supposed to do. And literally you were judged within the first 2 hours of your day. It used to drive me crazy because they were judged by the same people that sucked for the first 6 months when they were there too, because there's no training and no blue book and no strategy and no onboarding. And so I think you do it by A, being patient, 2, instilling humility into the people that are doing the hazing. I mean, that's how I got away with it. I just kind of I kind of razzed those people. I kind of reminded them that they were just like them a couple of years earlier, and started really cutting people that weren't able to deploy that empathy. And so it's not really hard if you care to do it. I think none of these questions are hard. It comes down to the actions. But I think it comes down to leadership. If you let it happen, it's going to happen. You know, I would run down there those 4 years, and it took a long time for me to, like, I had to hire one major person, which sucked because I really gave them 7 chances. Back to an earlier recall question. But he just couldn't get there. And so eventually, and it opened the floodgates. Once that happened, it got better. And that's that.
How much of your staff's time is spent on you as opposed to other projects?
Well, if you're talking about Team Gary, right? You know, D-Rock, India, Brittany, Andy K, Alex D. Simone, Zach, Stefan, Andrew, don't want to leave anybody else, Sid, the intern. They're using all their time. They're on my brand. Everybody else is not at all. I think there's, you know, VaynerMedia is not built to build the Gary V brand. They're there for client work. So I have it siloed out on my team. I think my comms team, my PR team bleeds a little bit. But other than that, I mean, the occasional, I'll ask somebody for a favor or jump into this. But there's, please don't let it be confused. And I think this is important when you've got multiple things going on in an organization. You silo them out. Back to that Navy SEALs and kind of the Army. My little ninja team that works on my brand works on my team as if I was, you know, Pepsi or Toyota. And so that's that.
How do you handle it when people miss their deadlines?
I hate missing a deadline because it's a black and white KPI. I always tell my employees, look, the creative is subjective. They may or may not like it, but getting it done on Tuesday is not subjective. Like if it's there Thursday, they're like, you did wrong. So I don't love it. At the same token, I always want to know why. I mean, look, if I find out the client was waiting for something a long time and they're upset, but I find out it was because 3 people were sick and then we went to get a freelancer, that didn't work out. Like, I'm always prepared for a proper excuse. I hate when people are like, there's no excuses. Of course there are. There's circumstances. There's things that happen. And so the way I react is I become Sherlock Holmes. If I care to know, which is rare because 99% of things don't matter, but if I care to know, I will jump into Sherlock Holmes mode. I will listen, and I'm lenient, so that's that. But like 50% of the time, I'm like, oh, okay, makes sense. Let's not do it again. 50% of the time, I'm like, hey, man, hey, gal, this is something we need to fix permanently, so don't let it happen again. And that's it. That's how I handle it.
How do you diplomatically tell the boss he's screwing it up?
All depends on the company. All depends on your situation. If you're a 24-year-old and mom and dad got your back and are willing to pay your rent, you've got a little more audacity to lose your job than if you've got, you know, a $100,000 student loan and a kid in a studio apartment and, you know, bills that are racked up. You're probably going to be a little bit more political. So first and foremost, I want to deploy empathy to all and every situation. But if you've decided to go there, I'm a big fan of honey over vinegar. Hedge. Here's my question. Do you want to basically tell somebody screw off, or do you want it to actually be fixed? If you want somebody to just get punched in the mouth and tell them to fuck off, right? Well, then come guns a-blazing and be like, you suck. But if you actually want it fixed, start with honey. Hey, John, I know that you're managing all of us, and that must be tough. I couldn't even imagine. but, you know, hey, we need to fix this, that, and the other thing. So I think diplomacy and being a real politician and starting with honey and then delivering your vinegar is a very good way to get a boss to change something. But are you interested in it changing, or are you just at wit's end and just want to let off some steam and let the chips fall? And so I think this is more on you than them.
When trying to get your point across to meet a goal, do you prefer to be abrasive or compassionate, and why?
I like everything. I think all emotions can be successful. I like having a tool belt of all emotions to deploy when I'm trying to get something achieved. I think what I really hope is that I have context and I know the person and I can really reverse what motivates them. So the more I know about the person, whether it's the client or whether it's an employee, the more likely I'll know which tool to bring out that time. Is it, you know, the nunchucks or the gun or the spear? You know, like what am I need to bring out this time to get the job done? And so I tend to lead with honey as often as possible. I really think compassion works. But sometimes, you know, you just got to use the alternatives, and I'm willing to do that as well.
What are your suggestions when you have to work with external partners to get the job done, but they don't share your hustle?
First, I want to come through for whoever you're coming through for. So if you're building a park for the town, first and foremost, you got to build the park. And so along the way, you may be frustrated as hell because Rick is sitting and drinking a beer under the tree and you're digging holes for the playground. Obviously, this is the analogy I'm using for a deck, for a project, for a pop-up shop, for an activation, for an event, for, you know, selling stuff. It applies to everything. As long as the judge and jury of the project knows what the score is, nothing bothers me. When we work with other agencies that are just using us up to be profitable on the project in their hourly wages, as long as the client then gives us more business in the future, I don't have a problem. It's when that balance doesn't work out. It's when meritocracy doesn't come through that you only have one option. I tend to leave. I'm always an A player. My organizations are always an A player. We're always going to play nice in the sandbox. We're not going to undermine people along the way. We're going to watch if the judge and jury, aka the client, recognizes this. If they don't, I will have a conversation. If they don't react to that conversation, I'll fire them. I don't have to stay in a bad relationship, but I don't have to complain about it along the way.
If you have a business that's growing fast, is it more important to perfect the system or to focus on adding more people to the team?
Both. The answer to this question is 100% both. I do believe that this is an insight to one of my best talents. I'm able to, I guess I'm sorry, I'll just use it because I heard it recently. And flying the plane while you're fixing it if it's broken. There's no other way to win because if you stop, you're not moving. And if you're moving without fixing, you're crashing. It's both, it's both, it's both. And I have big news for all of you. It's repairing and flying forever, always, till the end of time. This is nothing that ever stops. You're always parenting. I met a 90-year-old the other day, and we got to talking. I talk to old people on trips because they've lived life, and so I like the context. Asked me if I had kids, said 6 and 3. He goes, I have a 71-year-old. You're always parenting. And I just laughed, and I'm like, makes sense. It's like a business. It's just always the game. And so the answer is both. The only time you stop is when you sell your business. Otherwise, if you're stopping, you're creating a vulnerability in one or the other, in your growth or your continuity or your upside or your profitability or many other things. So be prepared for the challenge of moving and fixing along the way.